Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ede, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. We have three matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is John Norisis versus the City of Marina on St. Croix. Council, I know you're familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal, should you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brandon Schwartz, and I represent John Norisis in this matter. And the issue presented in this appeal is whether the district court abused its discretion and its factual findings were clear error when it relied upon affidavits and evidence that were not offered or received during the October 20th, 2022 order to show cause hearing. The only finding of contempt here was that Mr. Norisis continued to offer the property for rent in July of 2022 to an individual named Emily Severson, who did not testify at the hearing. The only individual who testified at the hearing was Mr. Norisis, and there was no evidence, there was no exhibits.
So what authority do you rely on that this really has to be, in order to show cause hearing, really has to be a trial type proceeding? Because I didn't see that in your brief.
Your Honor, we look at first Minnesota Statute 588.09, which says that when the person arrested has been brought into court or has appeared, the court or officer shall investigate the charge by examining the person and the witnesses for and against the person. We look at the Clausen v. Clausen case, which is from the Minnesota Supreme Court, 1957, that says, quote, in other words, the court cannot act upon facts within its own knowledge or information obtained outside of the orderly course of trial or upon the affidavit upon which the warrant issued, for it is not competent evidence
but
against.
But that's to make findings. I mean, I read all that as to say, I mean, or tell me why I'm wrong, that the judge can't just rely on the say-so of the person claiming that there's been a violation of a court order and that there has to be an opportunity for the person accused to be heard.
It's a two-step process, Your Honor. So we first have the 588.04 affidavit for the court to issue the order to show cause. Then we have the hearing on the trial of the contempt issue under 588.09. The case law, the Clausen case, the Westegar case, each of those say the court can't just look at the 588.04 information.
And where the other side has an opportunity to present evidence.
The other side has an opportunity to present evidence, but under 588.09, it's not just evidence saying I'm not in contempt. It's also the evidence that has to be presented saying here is what the contempt is. And where we generally see this, from looking at the case law and from my own practices, often in the child support cases or...
can be a criminal. I mean, that violation of child support orders ultimately can be a criminal matter, right?
It can.
Criminal contempt.
It can also be civil contempt. And where it usually happens is the individual who is getting the support or the county files the affidavit saying, here's the payments that should have been made. They weren't made. The order to show cause is issued, then they have the hearing. That same person or the agency then comes and testifies at the hearing under 588.09. The court doesn't just rely upon the 588.04 affidavit. So it's a two-step process. We first have the order to show cause evidence, and then we have the 588.09 hearing, and that's where the court got it wrong.
But I don't read 588.09 to require anything more than giving the alleged contemnor the opportunity to respond and be examined. I mean, it doesn't, what I hear you to be suggesting is that under 588.09, if the person who is seeking contempt doesn't offer any witnesses, then you can't have a contempt finding by the court? I mean, doesn't the statute just require the court to give the alleged contemptor the opportunity to respond to the contempt allegations?
I think it goes beyond that because it says examining the person and the witnesses for and against the person.
But if we adopt that reading, doesn't that mean that you could always, the alleged contemptor's attorney could always claim that there hasn't been enough due process if the alleged contemptor doesn't offer any witnesses? I mean, the alleged contemptor could choose not to offer any witnesses for him or herself, right? And then there would, under your reading of the statute, there would never be an ability to find contempt if they choose not to call anyone on their own behalf.
So that was what was discussed in the Westergaard case, in which this court actually said that because the individual did not appear, it was improper to hold him in contempt. But it goes further that says that doesn't mean that you can just skirt never coming to court, because then ultimately the district court could issue an order to show cause as to why you didn't and hold you in contempt on that. So I think, Your Honor, when you look at the 588.09, we look at the Clausen case, we look at the Westergaard case, each of those say that you have to bring in evidence to the contempt hearing. And the reason being is that if you're just relying upon affidavits on the 588.04 and you never get to examine the witnesses against you at the contempt trial, you have due process issues there. And a great example...
Couldn't you... I'm sorry to interrupt, but couldn't you subpoena witnesses? I mean, it doesn't... You, Mr... And how do you pronounce it? Norissus?
Norussus.
Norussus. It could have subpoenaed witnesses, could have deposed witnesses, could have... I mean... So it's not interfering with due process rights, is it?
But, well, this individual is not, as far as I understand it, Ms. Severson does not live in Minnesota, so being able to subpoena her was not an option. Second is, here, we brought Mr. Norussus in to answer the charge of, were you renting the property or did you offer to rent? The city still has to prove that there was a violation. Just submitting her affidavit as part of the 588.04 district court, please issue an order to show cause is not sufficient under the 588.09 hearing. And that's what...
But in this... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But as I understood the issue, the contested issue was not so much Ms. Severson's affidavit and the evidence presented through her affidavit of renting that property in July, but wasn't the issue of whether your client had anything to do with this property anymore. And I think he took the position that he didn't. He had quit-claimed it, and it was another entity that was doing these things back in July.
I think they go hand in hand, Your Honor, in that the issue was under the original temporary injunction was he can't rent it or use it for events unless he gets the license.
Correct.
And so he wasn't renting it or licensing it because he didn't own it anymore. But what the city had came back and claimed was that it continued to be offered for rent, and that's where they relied exclusively upon the affidavit of Ms. Severson. So I think they go hand in hand in that our position was he had no control over the property. He had an operator in place since June 6th.
Right. So how is the veracity, if you will, of the Severson affidavit really even implicated when the defense and the issue that you presented to the court was, I didn't have anything to do with whatever happened in July?
Because when you look at the district court's findings, the district court heavily relied upon the affidavit of Ms. Severson and that it claimed that she communicated with Mr. Norussus, in seeking to rent the property. And so that was what the district court really relied upon was...
Didn't the district court's findings, as they related to the allegations in the Severson affidavit, weren't they based entirely on the questions and answers by your client presented at the hearing regarding those allegations? And if this is civil contempt and not a situation where there's any sort of confrontation rights at issue, why isn't the testimony that Mr. Norussus presented at the hearing, where he was questioned about the Severson affidavit and answered that on the record, why isn't that an adequate basis for the district court to base its findings?
I don't think it was, Your Honor, and that if you look at finding of fact 10, it specifically says the city submitted an affidavit from Emily Severson. Severson states that on June 22nd, 2022, she requested to rent the property. So it wasn't just based on the questions and answers at the order to show cause hearing. And then if you go to paragraph 11, It also relies upon the affidavit of Mr. Reavers saying the property was listed for rent on Airbnb on the date the city filed its contempt motion.
So are you asking us to find those findings clearly erroneous because you're saying that Mr. Nerus has never testified about that evidence? I mean, the court's synthesizing what findings of fact it's making in this order, right? So if it finds based on his testimony that these facts are true, why isn't that appropriate?
He actually denied that. He said, I have no knowledge of it being rented. So I don't think the court can, the court is looking beyond the evidence that was admitted at the hearing because the affidavit of Emily Severson wasn't offered or received at the hearing. Neither was the affidavit of Mr. Reavers. It wasn't offered nor received at the hearing.
So he didn't deny that it was not offered for rent. And that's all the district court ultimately concluded is that it was offered for rent. So why can't this be treated almost as a summary judgment, in essence, in that the court has these affidavits. Your client doesn't deny that it was offered, the property was offered for rent. He just said, I have no knowledge of any of this. And so the court then said, well, you know, there being no conflicts of facts, I've got this unrefuted evidence that the property was offered for rent. And Mr. Nerusis is the ultimate owner of the property, even though he's now got a couple of LLCs in between. So what would be wrong with that, even though the city didn't present any witnesses?
He did deny it, Your Honor. If you look at page 19 of the transcript, I asked him, from and after June 9th of 2022, have you rented the property? No. Have you offered to rent the property from and after June 9th of 2022? No. So he did deny that on the record.
Well, but he had already quitclaimed it. I mean, wasn't that his whole point? On June 5th, he had quitclaimed the property over to the LLC.
He quitclaimed the property over to the LLC, put an operator in place because he's a Puerto Rican resident.
So again, his testimony that I didn't do this is not inconsistent with the district court's finding that somebody had offered this or for rent to Ms. Severson.
I think, Your Honor, though, but the order, as it relates to renting or offering to rent the property, is against Mr. Nerusis, and the finding of contempt is against Mr. Nerusis. He specifically put an operator in place because he's a Puerto Rican resident, couldn't apply for a license through the city so that the LLC could because there's a residency requirement for it. He had nothing to do with the property after that. So he couldn't,
he had the burden of proof and the judge just didn't believe him. The judge in essence kind of pierced the veil of these LLCs and said, I don't believe you. Ultimately, it seems like what would be wrong with us just concluding, well, Mr. Nerusis failed to satisfy his burden of proof here?
The judge didn't believe him, Your Honor, because he looked beyond the evidence that was admitted at the hearing. That's what the district court did, and that's what is error. And while the case...
So it was based on the fact that he thought his answers were evasive, that he found it hard to believe that he would transfer a property that was purchased for $1.1 million for less than $100,000. I mean, it was those things upon which the district court said, I just don't believe this.
But those things that there...
He lacks credibility is the
and,
ultimate...
And transferring... Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. The transferring the property into an LLC can be done for a number of different reasons. Here it was done for the operator. That doesn't mean that he rented the property. It doesn't mean that he offered to rent the property. And the district court looked beyond the testimony that was admitted here. And while the LAF, the 1924 case, was ultimately reversed, what the Supreme Court there said is we do not think the court was justified in holding untrue the evidence admitted at the trial by relying upon things that weren't admitted at the trial. That's exactly what was done here. Here we had, it was uncontroverted, because nobody else testified at the hearing and there was no other exhibits admitted at the hearing, that Mr. Nerusis did not offer the property for rent and did not rent the property. So the district court went beyond what was admitted and finding that Mr. Nerusis was, the words were untrue and unbelievable and all the different adjectives that were used.
So if we could switch for a minute to this issue of whether it's criminal or civil contempt. Now, there was no sanction imposed, and so there was no punishment. Is that right or wrong?
Your Honor, I think, and I see that my time is just about up. I think the district
you
court
can
was...
You respond on, wait, during your rebuttal.
Sure. I think the district court was inartful in its language. The language specifically says sanction in the finding. I think really what the district court was intending to do was the indemnify language of 588.11. But here, it really reads like a criminal contempt in that the purpose of civil contempt is to get somebody in compliance with the order, right? Here, there was no finding that there was an ongoing violation of the order. The findings of fact were he had in the past offered to rent, not that he was still offering to rent. And so it really reads more like a criminal contempt order wrapped up in a civil contempt order because there was no opportunity to purge the contempt. I think really when it says sanction.
But purge is, that applies, I mean, it doesn't really apply in an injunction situation, does it? Purge conditions? I mean, what, you're going to send somebody to jail until they agree to stop doing something? I mean, it seems like that only really applies when you're, the court's order is to require some kind of affirmative action. You know, like pay your child support or, you know, turn over something or show up for a hearing. I mean, but... I don't know if there was a question there.
May I respond to that?
I'm going to let you answer Judge Eade's question, then maybe Judge Siegel. Right. Judge can reframe it.
If in rebuttal. If the court had said, I'm going to fine you $2,000 a day until you take this posting down from VRBO, and I'm going to award the attorney's fees to the city. And your client took down the posting, and so there was no prospective $2,000 a day ordered, would the district court have to then vacate the attorney's fees order?
I think that would have been in accord with the case law of the purpose behind a civil and criminal contempt.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Wolf, counsel for respondent City of Marine on St. Croix. This court is really uniquely suited to make a decision in this case because it's essentially about judicial power and whether or not effective government will be impaired if we start to restrain the circumstances under which a district court may exercise or invoke its contempt powers. And those contempt powers are powers that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has said are not only inherent, but they are essential to the effectiveness of all other court powers. And appellant is asking the court to forbid courts from considering facts that are established in support of a motion for contempt when ruling on the motion for contempt. And for two reasons, the court should decline this invitation and instead affirm the district court's order, finding appellant in civil contempt. First, the rule that appellant is asking the court to create would be a new rule that no court has ever applied in a civil contempt proceeding. The second reason is that the court doesn't need to create any new rules in order to affirm the district court's decision because appellant did not meet his burden of proof. Regarding the first point, Minnesota law...
So I've got a question. The district court, without elaborating on it, does kind of skip through these two LLCs and said Mr. Norusis violated the injunction by continuing to offer to rent. So, I mean, isn't that problematic? And there was no testimony presented by the city. So,
So I think the evidence, you know, shows that Mr. Norusis transferred the property to an LLC that was owned by another LLC, which he is the sole owner of. And you know, I'm not going to pretend to be the, you know, expert on piercing the corporate veil or anything like that, but I would note that the order is pretty general in requiring Mr. Norosis to not rent or offer to rent without first obtaining a license in accordance with the ordinance. And the ordinance itself doesn't say you have to be a property owner if you, in order to violate this. It says anyone who offers to rent or rents a property is in violation of this. So, you know, theoretically, you know, if Mr. Norosis hadn't, you know, changed hands with the property and said, I'm going to just delete my Airbnb account and have my buddy sign up for an Airbnb account, that person could be violating the ordinance because that person would be offering to rent the property that's not licensed. Does that make sense, I guess?
I guess that's for us to decide later.
Sure. So, and I think when we talk about, you know, the evidence and what it showed, I would just, you know, reiterate the point that Minnesota law does not prevent the court from looking to the affidavits that were, you know, submitted in support of this. And, you know, when we say we're going to look to 588.09, and that says that at the contempt hearing, the court has to investigate the charge by examining witnesses and the person charged with contempt. So that statute was enacted in 1986, but for all of Minnesota's history, there's been almost a nearly identical statute. You know, if we can go back to the territorial statutes, Chapter 92, almost the same exact statute. So we've got this long history of this examination requirement, but we have no court decision that says in the civil contempt proceedings, the court must examine the witnesses that are submitting affidavits or presenting evidence in support of the contempt motion.
So then it raises the question, was this really a civil contempt proceeding when there's no finding about an ongoing violation at the time of the hearing and no conditions set to purge? It feels more like criminal constructive contempt to me. And if that's true, did Mr. Norosis get the process to which he's due?
I think he did get the process to which he's due, and I do think it's quite clearly a civil contempt situation here because there was no sanction placed on him. There was no purge conditions because the fact of the matter was Mr. Norosis was being charged with violating an injunction. The court doesn't need to say you need to do A, B, and C. The court already said that when it issued the injunction. You need to do A, B, and C. You did not do A, B, and C, so I can hold you in contempt, and there doesn't need to be any purge conditions because the order already on the books requires Mr. Norosis to do A, B, and C.
So how do you how do we read conclusion of law number 11 that the court purports or expressly says this is the appropriate sanction? Do we just say that's inartfully stated and go to conclusion of law number 10 that references indemnity and 588.11?
I would agree with counsel for appellant that it was a bit unartful using the word sanction. I think when people think attorney's fees, they think sanctions or, you know, cost-shifting statutes. But the court pretty clearly said in its order that it was relying on 588.11, which is the, you know, the part of the statute, the contempt statute, that allows the court to indemnify parties for the costs and fees that they incur in prosecuting a contempt. And the indemnity, the ability to indemnify a party is, you know, distinct from a sanction. It's, you know, just making the city whole and the fact that the city had to incur costs in order to try to get Mr. Norosis to do what he was already required to do.
In order for the order to be civil and remedial, are civil contempt orders limited to situations where there's an ongoing, where there is ongoing misconduct?
Civil contempt is not, I guess it would depend on how you define misconduct. I would say it's not limited to situations where there's ongoing misconduct, unless misconduct means you're not obeying the court order that I already, entered. There's a case, the Smoot case, that respondents cited in their brief. That was a case where the court affirmed that the examination requirement can be satisfied by submission of affidavits. This is the examination requirement for the alleged contemptor. And in that case, the court said, you know, we find it notable that The court did not sanction the contender. It just said, comply with the, you know, marital dissolution order that I already told you to comply with. There's no punishment. There's no purge conditions, because it's just saying, you know better. You should be doing this already.
So let me put the same question to you that I did to your counterpart. If the court here had said, I'm going to fine you $2,000 a day until you come into compliance with the injunction, and there was a showing that Mr. Nusis did come into compliance, but there was still an attorney's fee award, would the district court have been required to vacate the attorney's fee award?
If the court could not hold Mr. Nusis in contempt because he had complied, then I would say that it would. I'd have to look at the statute again, but I believe it's sort of dependent on there being a finding of contempt. So if there is no contempt, there's no attorney's fee award. But I would have to double check that.
Saying that if there has been a violation, but no finding, like we have in this case, of an ongoing violation, that the court still can find somebody in civil contempt.
So, and as I understand,
so kind of why, when it's supposed to be forward looking.
Sure. So as I understand the question, the court can still find, I would say yes, it can, because if the purpose of the contempt motion is to get Mr., you know, any person to comply, and then they comply because the motion was brought, and the city or whoever still incurs those fees in order to gain that compliance, there doesn't need to be a finding that you're in an ongoing violation. The purpose of the contempt motion has been satisfied, and that person is entitled to indemnity for the fees they incurred in prosecuting it.
I guess my question to you is then, is the only situation in which you could have gotten attorney's fees for your client a situation in which the court says, I'm going to fine you $2,000 a day, Mr. Nusis continues to defy the injunction, the court has to impose the $2,000 a day for whatever period of days, and then you get attorney's fees? Or did the court have the discretion to say, I'm going to fine contempt here, and I'm just going to give you attorney's fees, comply with my injunction?
The latter, because like I said, if the motion is successful in gaining compliance, even if it's not successful, if there's no sanction involved, it's a civil contempt situation, because it's not for the purpose of punishing. The indemnity is entirely separate. It is not a sanction. It is purely to make the prosecuting party whole. And I'm getting to my last 5 minutes, so I just wanted to hit on a couple of key points. The Hop opinion that we cited in our brief, that, you know, that's kind of the standard for civil contempt. And in that case, the court outlined, you know, eight different prerequisites that have to be present in civil contempt. And the fourth and fifth requirements are the most relevant here. In the fourth, it says the party adversely affected needs to apply to the court for aid and compelling performance and give specific grounds. The fifth says a hearing must be conducted at which the party charged with non-performance be given an opportunity to show compliance or reasons for failing to comply. And the Chief Judge Siegel mentioned this, that it is the burden of proof on the alleged contemner at the hearing to show that they either complied or they have reasons that they didn't comply. And if we look at other jurisdictions, this is sort of the way that civil contempt has evolved into almost like a dispositive motion, where the affidavits and the evidence presented set the basis for the contempt. The person comes to the hearing, they get examined by the court, they can call witnesses, they can introduce evidence, and they can subpoena individuals if they so choose. And that's really the authoritative law on this. I mean, Clausen, which has been mentioned a few times, they quoted, you know, an older case, the Ives case from 1895, but the Clausen holding simply says the alleged contemner has to be examined. It doesn't say the witnesses for or against have to be examined. And Hop came after Clausen, and Hop doesn't say anything about examining witnesses either. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Hop set up a procedure that's essentially the same as the evolving common law in other states where they don't have these contempt statutes, and civil contempt has evolved into a situation where it's almost a burden shifting. So, when we're looking at the HOP standard, that it was Mr. Norosis's burden to show that he either complied or had reasons for not complying, he took the strategy to say, I don't know anything about this. I don't know if there are rentals. I didn't rent it, but I got someone in place who I haven't spoke to since I signed the agreement. He may have rented. I have no idea. I haven't spoken to him. The court said, that's really not believable to me. And on transcript page 21, I mean, counsel for appellant questioned Mr. Norosis about the affidavit, or the declaration, which established that the property had been rented, pointed to the exhibit, which showed she left a review on Airbnb. So it's established that the property had been rented. And that's really all the court needed to find, because it didn't find anything else Mr. Norosis said credible about the fact that he knew nothing about what's been going on with the property since the injunction was ordered. And just to reiterate lastly that the argument that this is a criminal contempt, I would point again to the specific language the court used to cite to Minstat 588.11, because that's, that can't be, you can't have a slip of the tongue and say a specific statute. You can't accidentally use the word sanction. But that was pretty specific. That was an indemnity. And then if there's any other questions, I have about a minute left. I can answer them now. But
anything further? I don't think so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwartz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start where counsel left off there. There was actually no finding that it was rented. The finding was that it had not been rented. So when he says in the record that it says that she left a review that she had rented it, that's not what the record says. She had not rented it. Clausen is still good law. That was not reversed by Hopp. And what Hopp says, Hopp does not hold that the court can rely upon evidence outside of the record. What the Hopp case said was this procedure for the contempt hearing, one of which was allowing the person who's been accused of contempt to come in and say, either I was not in contempt, or I was in contempt, and here's why, because I couldn't comply with it. Mr. Norosis did come into court, testified, and said, I haven't rented this property. I haven't offered to rent this property. So Clausen is still good law. The Smoot case that counsel referenced, there, the plaintiff actually admitted to violating the order. So that's a different type of case. And to the questions that Judge Bjorkman and Judge Siegel asked about civil contempt and criminal contempt, civil contempt proceedings are designed to induce future performance, not punish for past failure to perform. That's what was done here.
Where's the punishment? I mean, I think that, yes, the district court inartfully used the word sanction, but clearly the conclusion of law number 10 says this is a 588.11 indemnity for actual loss occasioned by the contempt. So how do we get from that very clear order or conclusion to conclude that this was criminal?
Because the purpose of civil contempt being to induce future performance, when he was in compliance with the order, this is criminal contempt in that it's punishing for past behavior.
Civil contempt orders can include sanctions for past behavior. We just in May, we published a decision in State v. Iron Waffle. It's 990 Northwest 2nd, 513. And in that case, the temporary injunction was allegedly being violated. There was an order to show cause hearing on May 18th, 2021. And then the court eventually held that there was contempt and fined the person a sanction for conduct that occurred before the hearing, in addition to conduct that continued after the hearing. So why can't a sanction for civil contempt include both conduct leading up to and then continuing on afterwards?
I think it could, but what's missing here is the conduct afterwards. That wasn't ongoing. The order, the findings here were, one, that he had not rented it, and that he wasn't renting it still. It wasn't offered to rent. It was in July, the court found that it had been offered to rent. It wasn't an ongoing offer.
Predicate that brings someone to court for an order to show cause. They did something. You file your motion for an order to show cause. They come to court, and you deal with it. And in this case, doesn't it only come down to whether or not the indemnity, which you agree is 588.11 indemnity, is a sanction, or if it's attorney's fees indemnity? Isn't that the difference?
I agree that 588.11 is indemnity, which can include attorney's fees, yes. I also, the court's order says sanction.
Timeshare Systems versus Schmidt, which was cited in the briefing, I mean, that was a past, that's civil contempt, and that was for a past, they deleted files, and a sanction was imposed, and it was upheld. And so how is this case different from Timeshare Systems?
I think what's different there is those files are deleted and gone forever, so they couldn't be brought back. Here, he was in compliance.
But it was still held to be civil contempt. So what is the distinction? What are we to hang our hat on in order to rule in your favor?
Well, first, I don't think we need to get to that point on the attorney's fees being indemnity or sanction, because I don't think there was contempt.
In Timeshare, there was an actual monetary sanction of $2,500 or something like that because these files were deleted in violation of the court order. So that's past conduct, but it's civil contempt. So there was a sanction, and I think there were attorney's fees, but there was a monetary sanction, and it was treated as civil contempt for past behavior. So it wasn't for future. So how is your case different?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, and candidly, if the court wouldn't have said this is a sanction, I don't think we would be arguing that piece. I think what we would really be focused on is the finding of contempt, which he should not have made because it relies upon evidence outside of the record.
Okay, you're missing my point, though, here. So Timeshare Systems, the court, in a precedential published opinion, our court said you're being fined $2,500 because you deleted files in the past, and that's civil contempt. So here, there's no sanction at all, or there's attorney's fees, so we've got this issue of was it a sanction or was it 588.11. But why is this case then criminal when Timeshare Systems says that it's civil contempt and we're punishing you for having in the past deleted files in violation of our court order?
I don't think I missed your point, Your Honor. I agreed with you.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I don't mean to be.
And my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.